Chapter 8. I Can't Keep Throwing Things at Them. Up in the Maryland's foretop, Seaman Leslie Vernon Short had abandoned his hopes of a quiet morning addressing Christmas cards. After a quick double take on the planes diving at Ford Island, he loaded the ready machine gun and hammered away at the first torpedo planes gliding in from Southeast Lock. In the destroyer anchorage to the north, gunner's mate Walter Bowe grabbed a 50-caliber machine gun on the afterdeck of the Tucker and fired back too. So did Seaman Frank Johnson, who was sweeping near the bridge of the destroyer Bagley in the Navy Yard. Seaman George Sallet watched the slugs from Johnson's gun tear into a torpedo plane passing alongside, saw the rear gunner slump in the cockpit, and thought it was just like in the movies. Others were firing too. The Helena at 1010 dock, the Tautog at the sub base, the Raleigh on the northwest side of Ford Island. Up in the Nevada's birdbath, a seaman generally regarded as one of the less useful members of the crew seized a 30-caliber machine gun and winged a torpedo plane headed directly for the ship. It was to be an important reprieve. Here and there other guns joined in, but at first they were pitifully few. A number 3 condition of readiness was in effect. That meant 1 anti-aircraft battery in each sector, and orders had been given to man additional guns on the battleships. But whatever the official directives, the men actually on the ships recall no difference from any other peacetime Sunday. On some ships, key men were still ashore, 5 of the battleship captains, 50% of the destroyer officers. On others, men were pinned down by strafing, blocked by watertight doors, dazed by the suddenness of it all. Seaman Robert Benton, a sight-setter of a 5-inch gun on the West Virginia, stood helplessly at his post. The rest of the gun crew never did appear. Yeoman Alfred Horn waited alone so long on the signal bridge of the sub-tender Pelias that he finally gave up. He started back down the ladder, almost into the arms of the skipper, who thundered, "Where the hell do you think you're going?" There were more delays once the men reached their stations. First, the canvas awnings that stretched over the decks and guns. On the Sacramento, water tender Gilbert Hawkins found himself carefully untying each knot. He just couldn't shake off the peacetime way of doing things. Finally, a cook ran up and slashed the lines with a butcher's knife. Other men struggled to get guns and ammunition. At Ford Island, a supply officer took a firm stand. No 30-caliber machine guns without a US&A 307 stub requisition. On the helm, a gunner's mate asked Commander Carroll's permission to get the keys to open the magazine locks. The skipper said, "Damn the keys, cut the locks." On the New Orleans, they used fire axes to smash open the ammunition-ready boxes. The Pennsylvania locks were knocked off by a gunner's mate who walked around swinging a big hammer. He'd been bombed by the Japanese on the gunboat Panay in 1937 and announced he wasn't going to be caught again. On the Monaghan, bosun's mate Thomas Donahue, relieved of all duties to return to the mainland, ran back to his old job as captain of No. 4 gun. While the ammunition locks were being sawed off, Donahue whiled away the time slinging wrenches at low-flying planes. Then somebody called up from the magazine and asked what he needed. "Powder," he called back. "I can't keep throwing things at them." They took him literally and sent up powder without shells. Nothing daunted, he used a drill shell for his first shot at the enemy. At least it was better than a wrench. On the afterdeck of the Detroit, men banged their 3-inch shells against the gun shields to get the protector caps off the fuses, and aviation metalsmith George Dorfmeister wondered why the whole ship didn't go up in smoke. On the Bagley, a 5-inch gun crew trained on a low-flying strafer. Seaman George Sallet squeezed the trigger, and nothing happened. Somebody on the Honolulu just astern yelled and pointed to the barrel. Nobody had taken out the tampion, a decorative brass plug that seals the barrel when not in use. Whereupon, the crew on one of the Honolulu's afterguns forgot their own tampion, but here it didn't seem to matter. The first shot blew it out, and on they fought. More and more guns were firing now, but 10 priceless minutes had passed. At a time like this, they made a life-and-death difference on Battleship Row. Another plane glided toward the Nevada. Again, the machine guns on her foretop blazed away. Again, the plane wobbled and never pulled out of its turn. The men were wild with excitement as it plowed into the water alongside the dredge pipe just astern. The pilot frantically struggled clear and floated face up past the ship, but this time they got him too late. Marine Private Peyton McDaniel watched the torpedo's silver streak as it headed for the port bow. He remembered pictures of torpedoed ships and half expected the Nevada to break in two and sink enveloped in flames. It didn't happen that way at all. just a slight shudder, a brief list to port. Then she caught a bomb by the starboard anti-aircraft director. Ensign Joe Tausig was at his station there, standing in the doorway when it hit. Suddenly he found his left leg tucked under his arm. Almost absently he said to himself, "That's a hell of a place for a foot to be," and was amazed to hear bosun's mate Alan Owens, standing beside him, say exactly the same words aloud. In the plotting room five decks below, Ensign Charles Merdinger at first felt that it was all like the drills he had been through dozens of times. But it began to seem different when he learned through the phone circuit that his roommate Joe Tausig had been hit. The men on the Arizona, forward of the Nevada, hardly had time to think. She was inboard of the Vestal, but the little repair ship didn't offer much protection. A torpedo struck home almost right away, and nothing could stop the steel that rained down from Fuchida's horizontal bombers now overhead. A big one shattered the boat deck between number 4 and 6 guns. It came in like a fly ball, and Seaman Russell Lott, standing in the anti-aircraft director, had the feeling he could reach out and catch it. Another hit number 4 turret, scorched and hurled coxswain James Forbes off a ladder 2 decks below. The PA system barked, "Fire on the quarter deck," and then went off the air for good. Radioman Glenn Lane and 3 of his shipmates rigged a hose and tried to fight the fire. No water pressure. They rigged phones and tried to call for water. No power. All the time, explosions somewhere forward were throwing them off their feet. Alongside, the Vestal seemed to be catching everything that missed the Arizona. One bomb went through an open hatch, tore right through the ship, exploding as it passed out the bottom. It flooded the number 3 hold, and the ship began settling at the stern. A prisoner in the brig howled to be let out, and finally someone shot off the lock with a 45. Forward of the Arizona and Vestal, the Tennessee so far was holding her own, but the West Virginia on the outside was taking a terrible beating. A Japanese torpedo plane headed straight for the casemate, where Seaman Robert Benton waited for the rest of his gun crew. He stood there transfixed, wanted to move but couldn't. The torpedo hit directly underneath and sent Benton and his headphones flying in opposite directions. He got up, ran across the deck, slipped down the starboard side of the ship to the armor shelf, a ledge formed by the ship's 15-inch steel plates. As he walked aft along the ledge, he glanced up, saw the bombers this time. Caught in the bright morning light, the falling bombs looked for a fleeting second like snowflakes. The men below were spared such sights, but the compensation was questionable. Storekeeper Donald Brown tried to get the phones working in the ammunition supply room, third deck forward. The lines were dead. More torpedoes, sickening fumes, steeper list, no lights. Men began screaming in the dark. Someone shouted, "Abandon ship!" and the crowd stampeded to the compartment ladder. Brown figured he would have no chance in this clawing mob, felt his way to the next compartment forward, and found another ladder with no one near it at all. Now he was on the second deck, but not allowed any higher. Nothing left to do, no place else to go. He and a friend brushed a bunch of dirty breakfast dishes off a mess table and sat down to wait the end. Down in the plotting room, the gunnery nerve center and well below the waterline, conditions looked just as hopeless. Torpedoes were slamming into the ship somewhere above. Through an overhead hatch, Ensign Victor Delano could see the third deck was starting to flood. Heavy yellowish smoke began pouring down through the opening. The list grew steeper. Tracking board, plotting board, tables, chairs, cots, everything slid across the room and jumbled against the port bulkhead. In the internal communications room next door, circuit breakers were sparking and electrical units ran wild. The men were pale but calm. Soon oily water began pouring through the exhaust trunks of the ventilation system. Then more yellow smoke. Nothing further could be done, so Delano led his men forward to Central Station, the ship's damage control center. Before closing the watertight door behind him, he called back to make sure no one was left. From nowhere, 6 oil-drenched electricians' mates showed up. They had somehow been hurled through the hatch from the deck above. Then warrant electrician Charles T. Duval called to please wait for him. He sounded in trouble, and Delano stepped back into the plotting room to lend a hand. But he slipped on some oil and slid across the linoleum floor, bowling over Duval in the process. The two men ended in a tangled heap among the tables and chairs, now packed against the downside of the room. They couldn't get back on their feet. The oil was everywhere. Even crawling didn't work. They still got no traction. Finally, they grabbed a row of knobs on the main battery switchboard, which ran all the way across the room. Painfully, they pulled themselves uphill, hand over hand, along the switchboard. By now, it was almost like scaling a cliff.